Now to your fun bags and dingle bombers. What? Yes, indeed. Have we been making fun of them all too much instead of better understanding them? It's breasts. Human breasts are unique in the animal kingdom. Apparently, we're the only mammals who develop and maintain our breasts. Chimps only develop them while they're lactating. But science journalist Florence Williams argues human breasts are now living a life they've never lived before. And after forensically looking at why and how, it's got her very concerned what she's found. She believes breasts are bellwethers for the changing health of people. An argument she makes very powerfully, I have to say, in her new book, Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History. Florence is contributing editor at Outside magazine and a freelance writer in the US. She joins us now on the line from her home in Boulder, Colorado. Welcome to Life Matters, Florence.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Why a book on breasts, Florence?
Well, I believe that breasts are a sentinel organ for human health. They're a very visible and visceral way to tell the story of how our environments are changing our bodies. We know that breasts are very fatty tissues, and because of that, they are sort of particularly vulnerable to some of the substances, particularly industrial chemicals in our environment, many of which are attracted to fat. And we also know that breasts are filled with estrogen and progesterone receptors, and that these receptors are designed by evolution to interact with our environment. That's how breasts know when to start growing in puberty. It's how the mammary gland knows when to finish developing when a woman is pregnant. And yet now it appears that those receptors are actually picking up compounds that mimic hormones. We know that many household plastics, for example, mimic estrogen. And it certainly appears that at least in lab studies that mammary glands are really, really sensitive to these substances.
Let's backtrack, though. What was the personal trigger for you to tell the story?
Well, I was breastfeeding my second child, and as a science journalist, I saw some research that toxic chemicals were showing up in breast milk. So as a mother, this really, of course, concerned me. But as a journalist, I was really interested to try to tell this story. And so I sent a vial of my breast milk. I FedExed it to a lab in Germany. And it was tested for things like jet fuel and flame retardants and some pesticides. And that's what really launched me down this path of trying to understand how breasts work and how they interact with the world around us and what it means for our health and, of course, for our infants' health as well.
So what were the results of those tests that you had the Germans do for you?
Well, it turns out that I was very typical in that I had really relatively high levels of flame retardants. We know that American women have the highest levels of flame retardants in our bloodstream and in our breast milk, much higher than women anywhere else in the world. And it's really because of California and their flammability standards, which are laws that require, especially furniture manufacturers, to put flame retardants in, for example, upholstered foam furniture. And so our houses are particularly filled with these items of furniture, and our dust is filled with flame retardants. And I know this because after I found the flame retardants in my breast, I decided to try to figure out where they were coming from. And so I tested my household dust. I had high levels of flame retardants in my dust. Mm. And then I actually cut open some of my couches. I biopsied my couch. And I sent it to a lab at Duke University in North Carolina. And sure enough, we found flame retardants in my couch.
That's a shocking thing, isn't it? Well, you write some chilling words. You say we're living in a flame retardant nation. In your case, I'm certain it's the same in our case too. And that concerns you, but I guess I have to say, as a science journalist, as you are too, I imagine you'd be the first to agree that we don't necessarily want to contribute or cultivate a kind of chemical paranoia here.
Right. I think it's really easy to all of a sudden walk around your house and be very anxious about, you know, every piece of plastic and every piece of foam. And we know anxiety is not so great for your health either. So I think there's, you know, a careful balance of you know, just being a little bit vigilant, trying to understand, certainly as a science journalist, I wanted to understand, you know, what the health effects were from these, you know, albeit small amounts of chemicals. And I also, you know, became kind of more aware of the politics behind flame retardants. It turns out that we have a very powerful flame retardant industry, It's the manufacturers who make enormous profits from these substances, and they're the ones who have convinced, you know, the California legislature to enact these laws. And now we're finding out 30 years, 40 years later, that the evidence is really not there in terms of these substances even saving lives in household fires.
You chopped up your couch, you sent off your breast milk, you went to great extent, put a great effort in to at least locate the flame retardants in your own household. But what did you find out about what flame retardants might do to breasts particularly?
Well, we know that, it's very difficult to study a chemical, like a single chemical or a class of chemicals in humans, and that's because we're all exposed to so many. Mm. We know we have hundreds of chemicals coursing through our bloodstream. So it would be hard to look at, for example, a woman with breast cancer or a child with a neurological disease and say, this is caused by flame retardants. But what we can do is we can look at lab rats and lab mice. And even in some cases, monkeys. And there we can really control the exposures and see what happens when these animals are exposed to flame retardants. And what we've learned is that they're endocrine disrupting. So they do somehow interact with hormone receptors in our bodies, particularly the thyroid organ, which is in our neck. And the thyroid sends out hormones that regulate everything from metabolism to neurological development. And it helps us regulate our body temperature. So I've learned that, you know, many of these hormones have, you know, these sort of deep tail, long tails of biological effects. And so I think it's definitely worth asking these questions. And especially it's worth doing the cost-benefit analysis. You know, if we're going to be polluting our bodies unintentionally with these compounds, let's really ask if these compounds are worthwhile, you know, or if there's something safer we could use, or a different way to even make furniture that protects our infants and protects our breasts.
Yes, I mean, you're acknowledging that many of the substances like flame retardants in plastics, in, well, just about everything, furnishings, all sorts of things now, might disrupt our endocrine system. They kind of hijack our hormone system. But that doesn't necessarily say to us that they're a problem for our breasts.
Well, we know that our breasts are a conduit for these substances to our infants. So that when a woman has many years of accumulated flame retardants, in her tissue, in her fat tissue, the breast milk is able to mobilize those chemicals very efficiently and put them right into the breast milk. So that's, you know, that's where the breasts really come into play. They are one of the major exposures for infants to be exposed to these substances. But of course, infants also get these substances in the womb, which is important to say, and they also get them just from crawling around, you know, on carpets. And of course, we know infants put their fingers in their mouths all the time. They're sort of ingesting dust, you know, all the time. So the breasts are, you know, they're one kind of, like, as I'd like to say, a sort of charismatic symbol.
Yeah.
But really the story is much bigger.
They soak up pollution like a pair of soft sponges, you say. Look, Florence, you did an interesting experiment with your daughter to try and, in a sense, detect and gauge the impact of common household chemicals and products on your bodies. What did you do?
Yes, I did. I was interested in doing this because I've heard that younger and younger girls are developing breasts. And scientists are looking hard at this because we know that early puberty is associated with breast cancer later on. And it's also associated with social problems for girls, such as substance abuse and sexual abuse. So it's something that parents should be concerned about. Scientists are trying to figure out why. They think one of the major factors is diet and body fat. But there's also quite a bit of research going into these estrogenic and hormone-mimicking chemicals. And so researchers are testing girls' urine and blood for these chemicals and then, also examining them for when they start to grow breasts. So I thought it would be sort of interesting to test my daughter to see how she sort of compared to these other girls that have been tested. And I was curious to know, how do we get these exposures to these chemicals? And we were looking at things like bisphenol A, which is sort of known as the baby bottle chemical. It's used to harden plastic. It's also found in canned food and soda, which, of course, kids in our country consume a lot of. We were looking at phthalates, which are chemicals that bind, especially scent. So they're often found in shampoos or moisturizers, personal care products. Some of these have been banned in Europe, but not yet in our country. And then we were looking at a compound called parabens, which is a preservative also used in personal care products, and then something called triclosan, which is a very common microbicide. So it's sort of a disinfectant that's added to many, many soaps and other products like toothpaste. And so my daughter and I, we tested our urine for these substances, and then we tried to sort of go detox. We tried to limit our exposures by only eating certain kinds of food, by not using these smelly shampoos. And it was really eye-opening because we were able to drop our levels quite a lot. So to me, it showed us how easy it is to get our levels up in our bloodstream by these certain exposures. And then how dramatically you can change your levels by changing your lifestyle. But I will say that those changes were very extreme and not easy to do. I mean, I was a vegan for 3 days. I didn't use shampoo or deodorant.
You were a stinky vegan.
I was a stinky vegan science journalist. Really not a practical way to live your life or to be a parent.
Which really brought it home to you just how hard it is to avoid the chemicals of concern for you.
Yes, I realize that it's almost impossible for us as parents or as individuals, you know, to really filter this stuff out of our bodies in a meaningful way. And so I feel like it shouldn't even be our problem because, you know, it's really, I think, our government's problem and the manufacturer's problem that we have these substances around us in the first place that are messing up our hormones. So it made me realize we need to look farther upstream. We need to insist that these chemicals are tested for human health effects because in most cases they are never tested for human health effects. And we need to provide incentives for manufacturers to use safer chemicals in their products.
Florence Williams is my guest on ABC Radio National's Life Matters this morning. She's written a terrific book as a science journalist. It's called Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History. And we're focusing more on the unnatural history so far. But Florence, one of the arguments you make very strongly is that in a sense, well, the natural history of breasts has sort of biased our focus when we talk about breasts. We've actually neglected to look inside breasts because we've been so obsessed with the externalities of breasts, what they look like. We've sexualized them. Tell me the argument.
Yeah, that's exactly what I found. In many modern cultures, the breast is sort of looked at as this separate object, you know, this objectified sexual organ, often even on the internet. If you look at pictures of breasts, you just see the breasts. You don't see the rest of the face. You don't see the body. Men just like to look at breasts, and they sort of oogle them, and they think about them sexually. And it makes it, I think it definitely creates challenges, makes it hard to look at breasts in their sort of deeper complexity. And I think that a lot of scientists have found this to be the case, that we know so little about lactation. We know so little about human milk. We're so biased to sort of see breasts in a certain light.
And with what consequences? I mean, you did, in the book, you really do unravel the fantastic history. There's always a big fight in evolutionary biology over whether breasts are, you know, purely functional, purely for lactation, purely for breastfeeding, and or whether or not they're kind of adornments to attract the opposite sex.
There's a huge debate in anthropological circles about why we have breasts, because it turns out our breasts are very unique in the animal kingdom. And so why did humans get so lucky? You know, why do we have them? And yes, the debate comes down to, are they sexual signals for men, or do they somehow help the fitness of the woman and the infant? And I think the debate really matters. You know, are you going to ask me where I come down on this debate?
Yes, I have to ask, of course. Purely functional or purely adornment or a bit
right.
of both?
Or maybe a combination, exactly.
Yes.
I guess I don't really know the answer because there's no solid evidence either way. But I think it's important to recognize the biases of all the arguments, and particularly of the sexual selection argument, the sexual signaling argument. You know, I think anthropologists have this tendency to project their own biases and beliefs back into deep evolutionary time. But really, we don't even know when breasts evolved. There's no, you know, fossil evidence for breasts. When you exhume, you know, Ardipithecus or one of those early human ancestors, we don't know her cup size. We don't know when they developed. And so I think the argument really matters, though, because, we, you know, the dominant theory is this one of sexual signaling. And because of that, you know, for many decades, it's been very hard for women to talk about cancer of the breast. My grandmother had cancer, breast cancer, in the 1970s, and it really wasn't spoken of then. And so that's one way, you know, I think it's kind of hurt breasts, is that we haven't been able to have a conversation with it and about them until recently, about their health. And I also think, at least in our country, I don't know about yours, but we have a hard time getting women to breastfeed. And I think there's a lot of discomfort still with breastfeeding.
Certainly one of the things breastfeeding has been described as helping us with is the prevention of breast cancer. And I'm wondering about the future of our breasts now. You've given some careful thought to this. What about prevention? If we're talking about chemical exposure and the impact on our breasts, if we're talking about breast cancer, a great concern for many women, did you extract any wisdom on the prevention of breast cancer and the future of breasts?
Yes, I was really surprised to learn how few resources and how little money is spent actually looking at prevention of breast cancer. And it's sort of interesting to examine why that might be, but certainly our major national breast cancer groups, Komen, for example, have put a lot of time and money talking about mammograms and the importance of mammograms, raising awareness. This is very important, but you know, by the time you detect a cancer on a mammogram, it's sort of too late. I mean, you already have the cancer. And so a lot of women's activist groups are saying, you know, why don't we try to get breasts healthier in the first place, and not have to worry about how to treat it? You know, wouldn't it be nice if we didn't get it to begin with? And so they do want much more research going into prevention, and that means the sort of political issue of looking at chemicals. It's, you know, it's sort of hard to stomach in a lot of quarters in our country because it might mean more regulation. But certainly for women who really care about the prevention of breast cancer, they feel that this is a really critical area for the research to go in the future.
And it's good for me to acknowledge that there's a very powerful case study in your book of a man with breast cancer as well, that, who you spent time with. At the end of the story, are there things that you are now doing in your life and encouraging your daughter to do, in a sense, to prevent exposure to the chemicals that concern you now and to prevent breast cancer?
There are some things I try to do, but as I mentioned, I feel that the anxiety sometimes, you know, is not worth it because we can't control our exposures in a really meaningful way. But for example, I do sometimes, you know, I try to buy organic milk and I try to buy organic meat because sometimes those have fewer hormones in them. And for my daughter, I try to encourage a really healthy body image. I want her to learn to sort of value her body for what it is and to learn how to use it athletically. I want her to eat a healthy diet. These are things that appear to help prevent early puberty. That's a concern I have. It looks like a high-fiber diet is possibly associated with later puberty. So I want her to appreciate her body. And I'm trying to also combat, you know, the images that she will see as she gets older of women with altered breasts, either through Photoshop or through surgery. I think young people today are surrounded by these images of sort of fake or enhanced breasts. It's very hard to compete with that. And I think there's enormous pressure on these girls to surgically alter their bodies.
Yes, and there's a sort of beautiful irony at the end of our conversation that the year that the first woman had the first breast implant, Rachel Carson published The Silent Spring, all about the impact of endocrine disruptors, and of course that book celebrates its 60th anniversary this year. Florence Williams, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Thank you, it's been a pleasure.
And of course, Rachel Carson's Secret Spring is in fact celebrating its 50th anniversary this year, not 60th. Arithmetic gets you every time, doesn't it? In fact, there was a great piece in The Guardian on the weekend about the legacy of Secret Spring. Well worth a look. I tweeted it if you want to have a look. My Twitter handle is Natasha Mitchell. The Twitter handle for Life Matters is RN Life Matters. And science journalist Florence Williams, well, a footnote actually, she decided that the benefits of breastfeeding outweighed the risks, and she kept breastfeeding her second child, as it turns out, after all that. Her book is called Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History. It's out through Text Publishing in Australia, a great example of science writing and investigation, well worth a look. Coming up, some of your letters. ¶¶ So our Friday Talkback looked at the whole issue of childcare from every perspective. We got a whole range of calls and you've kept the discussion going on our website. Here's one from Sherida. The discussion today brings back memories of my motherhood. It never occurred to me that anyone should take responsibility for my children's care except for me and us. I worked when my children were little, but I chose jobs which were either at night or weekends when my partner could be with them. I had no family close to assist. Once I did work full-time during the day, and I paid a neighbour at that time. Another time at Christmas, I sent my children in a plane to stay with their grandmother whilst I built up my savings. If you have children, you should not expect other people, taxpayers, to help finance them. It's middle-class welfare. I wholeheartedly support the right of women to work, but I also feel if you have children, it's your responsibility and you must make adjustments to your lifestyle and not expect to have your cake, that is kids, and eat it too. Be satisfied with the basics and be grateful. And also Tony wrote, half the problem here is that it's considered a women's issue, and I notice all your guests are female. Another problem in our society is that it's too centred around the workplace and not the family. Very much a cultural thing. We are too career orientated in our culture. Other cultures don't judge each other on their jobs, and we could take a leaf out of them. I'd like to see more flexible working conditions, one where people can move in and out for various reasons, including family, study, travel. Please, let's work to live, not live to work. And David writes, dear Natasha, as a child-free observer of this discussion, it was reaffirming to my view of people to hear the views of some women who are quite happy to screw the blood out of their child carers, dare I say their fellow women, for no doubt this is a sector dominated by women carers, and or to socialise the costs of their child care. It does the heart good. I'm off to give my dog a big hug. Cheers, David. Thanks, David. And just this one from Jennifer. You'll remember our conversation from last week about the role of palliative care in the home and the whole experience of nursing a loved one to their last breath in your home rather than a hospital bed. Jennifer writes, I've just listened to your program, dying at home, and tears are streaming down my cheeks. I was privileged to be part of a team that nursed both my grandmothers at home. I was 19 years old when I helped my mother, sisters and aunt nurse my father's mother as she died from cancer at our home. As a young person, the experience was incredible and liberating. To share in a person's last days and hours is akin to sharing in a birth. It's such a privilege. Jennifer says, my other grandmother died last year in October. Again, with my mother, sisters and cousin, I was able to help nurse her and was there to hold her hand as she let go of life. I miss her terribly, but I feel so grateful that I was able to be there and say goodbye. The difference is that I'm now 41 and the experience was no less powerful and no less a privilege. The palliative care team and nurses who came to the house were wonderful and helped us manage Nana's pain. The experience was natural and positive despite its sad nature. Death is a passage that each one of us must pass through. But seeing my Nana's go ahead is reassuring and comforting. Thank you for your program. If it is the experiences that we have through our lives that shape us, then I have been shaped in positive and powerful ways in helping to nurse my dying grandmothers at home, Jennifer. And many more stories to that effect on our Life Matters Facebook page, which you can get to by searching RN Life Matters in Facebook or indeed on our website. And it got us thinking we might in fact even do a talk back on this topic at some stage because it seems to resonate hugely with you. Coming up, our Monday Modern Dilemma. This is Life Matters on Radio National and I'm Natasha Mitchell.